As announced, the topic today is the symbolism of mother worship in Hinduism. Now, this is a very interesting subject, not only from the Hindu perspective, but also from the standpoint of evolution of Godhead, evolution of practical spirituality. Why do we depend upon, or why do we look upon God as a divine feminine archetype? If you go by the historical records, you find the idea of looking upon God as the mother, the supreme divine archetype, was already there in many of the pre-Christian religious traditions, in the Greek mystery religions, in some of the pre-Christian European religious traditions. It is already there. Maybe the one unique aspect of what we are going to discuss today, which I'm going to focus on, the symbolism of puja, worship in general, that you find in Hindu temples, and also different rituals, different vessels, different utensils that you find, different forms of offering flowers, the conch, water, then you can find elaborate rituals. Frequently when you go to a Hindu temple, you find all kinds of names and forms, all imaginable, conceivable ideas of the sublime you find in Hindu religious tradition. But something very unique about all these diverse forms of worship and rituals is that they all essentially are built upon the central principle that God, in its most sublime, in its most exalted concept, is one divine energy, one all-pervading supreme divine reality that is present in everyone, in everything, and that is present everywhere. To give an example, many of the rituals include Sanskrit mantras, Sanskrit statements, which if translated into English will be like, you are politely inviting an honored guest to your home and you give him a place to sit and you offer him a glass of water. You may give him a flower as an act of your devotion. And then finally you see him off on the doorstep. Many of these mantras can be translated into English statements like this. Please come in. Please be seated. Ikatishtha, please sit there, please be seated, accept this small humble offering from us. And bless not only me and my family, but bless the whole humanity. That's the last part of it. So the idea that not only human beings, the whole creation is one spiritual entity. One spiritual family that always underlies all these external forms of worship. So many people, I have seen in many of the books in which you find a picture is given, you know, the monkey god of the Hindus. You find a muscular monkey form standing there. People, and also you find sometimes gods with a trunk, tail and things like that. So, unless, of course, Hindus have done their best not to explain these details to either their own fellow Hindus or to other people. So it's nobody's fault in a way. But there is a profound symbolism. My exposition, rather, it may be slightly academic, slightly pedantic, with a lot of Sanskrit quotations. I won't be doing justice to the subject or to you if I just give you a very simple, very watered down, very superficial explanation using the most popular of American jargons. I'll be doing the greatest injustice to you above all, and also to the subject, which I won't do that, which I'm not going to do. So this may appear to be a bit pedantic, a bit elaborate, and a bit academic, but it is worth the effort. Now, to begin with, why do we look upon God as mother? Now, whom do you really love the most in your life? Let us forget about what is happening now in it's a global phenomenon, the collapse of family structure, the collapse of the sanctity and sacredness that ancient civilizations attached to the relationship between a child and mother. Let us forget what is happening now, but let us focus on the universal, the ideal, the what we would like to do, what we would like to see. Now, the most intimate, the most humane, and the most spiritual relationship that you can ever have in your life is your relationship with your mother. That is something very interesting. Because it is said that mother alone can love you, even if you are not a very good, desirable specimen of humanity. That is something unique about it. A father may disown somebody who may bring discredit to the family name, but mother never does it. So I'm just giving an extreme example to focus on the main theme. So the relationship that we can have with our mother is the most natural and the most inseparable and the most sublime and the most humane and the most spiritual relationship that we can ever think of. So that's one thing. Now, in fact, in ancient times, children used to be sent to Vedic hermitages to study Vedas, scriptures, and so on. After finishing the education, when they left their Vedic schools, going back to their homes to marry, to become parents, to become mothers and fathers, husbands and wives and so on, to settle down in family life, before they left the school, they used to give a convocation address. And the first sentence in that convocation address was, Matrudevo Bhava, which literally means, let your mother be as respectable to you as God himself. So you attach a spiritual element to your relationship with your mother. Then comes other instructions. Pitrudevo Bhava, Acharyadevo Bhava, Didhidevo. It goes on, which I am not going to detail. In fact, your father and your teacher, your guest, and also fellow human beings, you should look upon them. You should look upon them as they have in their heart the divine spark, which we call the highest reality, spiritual reality present everywhere. That's why, you know, the word namaste, namaha, te, these two words coming together called namaste, namaskara, the same. What it means is, so you find people folding their hands, and when they say, my obeisance, it is not your slavishly surrendering somebody. Maybe Vedanta is the only religion that tells you that you don't have to surrender yourself to God. That's something very interesting. There are religions which literally mean surrender. In Vedanta, religion means freedom. You can be one with God. In fact, that's the highest goal of spiritual life. You eventually realize that the divine reality present everywhere is present in you. So essentially, you and God are the same essentially. It's not that every human being is God as such, but the divine spark is present in you. You realize this, and that's the royal highway to freedom. So you do not have to surrender yourself to anyone. That is something very interesting. Now, one unique aspect about this is, it is so ancient and it is still continuing. So this antiquity and continuity, that is what actually is so unique about this. It is ancient and it continues to exist in this 21st century. So I shall conclude this part of the talk, as an introduction, by quoting one great statement from the ancient lawgiver. His name is Manu. There are 18 ancient constitutions or smritis. Of his, Manu is the oldest, lived around 1900 BC. And there is a statement, Upadhyaya Dashacharya Acharya Tu Shatampida Sagasrena Adhigam Pituhu Gauravena Tirichyate. Upadhyaya Dashacharya means, now here there are certain statements made. Upadhyaya means somebody who comes to a university to give a lecture once a while. He is Upadhyaya, guest lecturer, so to speak, an instructor who instructs for a short time. Now, the respect you give to a professor, the one who is responsible for the entire academic program, is called a professor. Now, the respect you give to a professor is 10 times the respect you give to an occasional guest lecturer. And the respect that you should give to a father is 100 times the respect you should give to your instructor, your teacher, your professor in the university. And the respect you give to your mother is 1,000 times as much as the respect that you give to your father. So, sagasrenadhikam pituhu gauravena atirichyate. So, mother is to be respected and honored 1,000 times as much as you honor and you respect your father. Now, this is a great statement from the ancient lawgiver. Now, this is the uniqueness of the mother ideal in the family setting. Now, our subject is Durga Puja and symbolism, mother worship and so on. So, you know, every puja occasion in Sanskrit is called Utsavaha. Utsava means a celebration. Now, Utsute Harsham Iti Utsavaha. Something that gives you an occasion of festivals that gives you tremendous joy, happiness. That is the meaning of Utsava. So, Utsute Harsham Iti. Harsha means joy. It is not merrymaking, joy, inner joy and contentment. So this Utsava, which is celebration, in a way, if you look at the great celebrations that have come to Christianity from pre-Christian European, what you wrongly called heathen religions, which is very, there are some of them were so exalted in the spiritual concepts. Or maybe from the ancient Hebrew, Jewish tradition. They had this element. It is an occasion for joy. The what kind of joy? This joy has two aspects. One is yoga and the other is for spiritual upliftment. So every religious celebration is a wonderful time for you to have a wonderful feast, and also is a wonderful time for fasting. So feasting and fasting, both are equally important elements of any celebration. So when it becomes enjoyment, a group gathering, meeting together, it becomes yoga. when it becomes something spiritual, then it involves fasting, reading scriptures, practice of silence. That's where Gandhi learned this art of keeping quiet, you know, the great silence that Gandhi was famous for, from Jaina religion, which again was an offspring of Hindu tradition. So there are certain celebrations when you fast and also you remain silent. So that is called tyaga. So tyaga is the spiritual element, which literally means vrata. So you find this vrata. Vrata literally translates into vows, which has got a spiritual element, which you undertake with great joy and with great sense of sanctity. It is not something that you voluntarily practice by biting your teeth. So I've seen this happening. You know, in the Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna strongly warns against self-inflicted vows and rigid practices. Yukta ahara viharasya yukta cheshtasya karmasu yukta sukna avabodhasya yogo bhavadi dukkha. That is a statement. Means we should practice moderation in eating, and we should in feasting, and we should practice moderation in fasting also. If our mind is not ready to practice this renunciation, the tyaga, the vows, self-imposed disciplines, that is vows, vrata. Then what happens, you know, you may fast, but you will start criticizing others who don't fast. See, I am very strict, I am very rigid, I am very austere. These fellows, you know, they eat all the time. So instead of becoming spiritually evolved, we become intolerant of others who don't practice our vows. So it is a kind of voluntary, self-imposed, self-denial of food and enjoyments undertaken with a great sense of joy and sanctity and sacredness. Then every utsava or celebration becomes vrata. It becomes a spiritual practice. Otherwise, it is okay. It becomes an occasion for people to come together, for family members to meet, and so on. Now, coming to Durga Puja, you find there are certain Sanskrit terms that we use for Mahalaya, which is the beginning of these festivities. I decided to focus on the Durga Puja aspect of the scripture background, because this is the time when in India, people from different religious traditions worship the Divine Mother, the God as the universal or pervading divine reality, as a feminine archetype in different places. And here in this temple, we worship Durga Puja. So I thought I would focus on that. Now, you have seen Holy Mother's name. Frequently, it is spelt as S-A-R-A-D-A. And frequently, it is spelled as S-H-A-R-A-D. That is something to do with this celebration we are talking about. This worship is normally undertaken in the autumnal season. It's called Sharat Kala in Sanskrit. So Sharat means autumn season. So the one who is worshipped in the autumn season, so Sharat Kale Pujida is Sarada. And then Sarada means, Saram is the spirit, the highest spiritual significance. Saram Dadadi, the Sarada. So this mother, the universal divine archetype, is the one who will give you all that you pray for. Spiritual liberation, spiritual upliftment, and also secular prosperity. That you can ask only from your mother. You can ask from your mother whatever you want. And if you are fit, then mother may also give you a higher level of spiritual status where you don't ask for anything. You are always in a state of perpetual contentment. So in that sense, mother gives you saram, the highest spiritual enlightenment. Or the mother gives you all that you need. So bhakti, bhukti and mukti, devotion, liberation, and also for those who are asking, praying for secular prosperity, mother gives you secular prosperity also. So the beginning of this celebration is called Mahalaya. That is the beginning of the puja festivities. So Mahalaya literally means merging of bhakti and jnanam. That means knowledge and devotion. Our mind gets merged in devotion and knowledge. And as a result, we become one with our own Atman. So that laya means merging together. Mind being merged in knowledge and Atman. That is Mahalaya. Now this is frequently observed in Mahalaya Amavasya. These are very, very popular terms which we use in many temple celebrations, but frequently we may not take full notice of. So this Amavasya has something to do with the position of stars and galaxies. Surya Chandramasuhu Yepara Sannikasa Sa Amavasya. What is Amavasya? When the sun and moon are coming together, it is calculated according to the old Hindu Vedic mathematics and also astronomy and astrology. So it is the occasion when the sun and moon come nearest to each other. And that's a time when our mind merges in devotion. Devotion corresponds to moon and knowledge, spiritual enlightenment, spiritual effulgence, which corresponds to sun. So when the sun and moon come together, that particular condition is called Amavasya. So Upayohu Upadyatha Bhavanna Sama Sutra Padanyanena Ekarasya Vachabdena Sahavasthana Rupaha. These are all certain important statements which support these views. And I'm just quoting one of the ancient smritis, which are frequently referred to when people decide the exact dates for different worship during this season. So the purpose of worship is to invoke the all-pervading divine reality in the image. So you have seen the image, for example, these images. Nobody worships an image. What you worship is the divine reality that you invoke on the image by means of our concentration and prayer. And it is that divine reality that we pray to, that we worship. It is not the physical image that is worshipped. That's why at the end of these festivities, you find all these images are thrown into the ocean. So all the images that you worship, all the external symbols that we worship, should be thrown into a flowing water. That is the old ancient tradition. Means these are all Pancha Mahabhudas, five elements, physical things which come and go. But the divine reality that we invoked to be present on the image by our own concentration, our own prayer, is present there during this season. We worship, and then towards the end, we request that divine reality. Now, Mother Divine Reality, you go back to your transcendental, omnipresent, all-pervading dimension. So the divine reality, the divine energy that is present everywhere, that is present in everything, that is the transcendental reality, is now invoked, prayed for with the great sense of sanctity and sacredness, to be present on the image or a photo. And then, and now, how do we invoke the all-pervading divine energy to be present on a picture, an image? Well, depending upon our own sincere prayer. It is not something that you can manipulate at a physical level. But when a real worshipper with a pure heart prays with all sincerity, with all sense of sanctity, which is called Saddha, then the divine reality, divine energy, in a feminine form, becomes present on the image that you worship, and then you offer to that divine reality water, flower, you find the conch or dissolve. These are different, there are important symbolic meanings which I'm going to discuss elaborately. So that is the importance of image worship. And then this physical symbol, physical entity is discarded. That's why in all big temples, they be called Puna Pradishtha. You, from time to time, maybe for long years, the worship was not properly conducted. Rituals were not properly conducted. People make a place sacred by their prayer, their meditation. It is not that God is sitting somewhere on a piece of stone, not at all. But when you pray, when you look upon that auspicious entity, maybe an image or a photo, whatever it may be, with a great sense of sanctity and sacredness, then the all-pervading divine reality becomes present. That's what happens. That means the impersonal, transcendental dimension of God is always at the basis of even the most, or maybe the grossest form of external worship. So that's why, you know, this sun coming to this Kanya Rashi is symbolic of the victory of truth and knowledge over ignorance and its opposite. So again, I should conclude this Mahalaya. So the great dissolution or samadhi or mukti, that is Mahatam Layaha. That is the meaning of Mahalaya. That's why this Mahalaya Amavasya, which is the auspicious time when the sun and moon come together, which is considered to be very auspicious, is considered to be the proper time for beginning of this prayer. That's why Drishyade Uparyatho Bhava Pannasama Rashyekam Sahavasthido Chandra Suryo Yatra, where Rashi means a particular moment in the moment of constellations of stars. We cannot prove it physically, but the position of the galaxy, the stars, and the terrestrial entities do have an important place on the human mind and also on the destiny of human endeavors. That's an old ancient belief. Anyway, so now coming to the puja proper. In Hindu tradition, every puja, every ritual can have a very auspicious, sublime, it's called sattvika form. Sattvika means more exalted, more sublime. And rajasika. Rajasika means it's a middle, where you have a very huge, spectacular display of rituals, a lot of things that you can see, and also in a very, very primitive, ignorant form of worship. Well, I shall try to explain this in the light of an example from Sri Ramakrishna's gospel. So Sri Ramakrishna says, devotion or spiritual practice can be sattvic, of an exalted type, rajasic, very spectacular, and tamasic, very primitive. Those who have this exalted form of worship, or an exalted idea, approach to spirituality, they may worship perhaps with one flower, one fruit, and they have a lot of chanting and meditation. That is sattvic form. A lot of meditation, a lot of introspection, a lot of sense of sanctity and sacredness. Absolutely nothing spectacular. No display of pomp, money, power or anything. So that form of worship where it is so sattvic, so spiritually oriented, that is one. The second one is one kind of worship where you may spend millions of dollars, huge infrastructure, where people wearing all kinds of very spectacular clothing, a lot of pomp and power and display. That is rajasic. And there are people, well, they may not have the sanctity, the concentration, the sense of sanctity of the sattvic, or they may not go for this display. They are very lazy, very ignorant, so they may do some kind of primitive worship like that. Worship, this you find in all traditions, you find in all spiritual traditions. A great mystic may be always mentally living in the world of God. And those who are not so advanced may well have a huge marble structure. You can find huge Hindu temples, Christian cathedrals, Islamic mosque and Buddhist temple. Huge. Lot of money and all that. That is rajasic. And there are those who are just the beginning of the spiritual evolution. They don't have the pomp and display of the rajasic, or they don't have that exalted spiritual approach of this sattvic. So this is common to all traditions. That's why the Durga Puja can be of three kinds: sattvika, rajasika and tamasa. So sattviki javayajnadehi nivedeshcha niramishaihi mahatmyam bhagavatyascha puranadishu kirtidam padastasya japas prokta pathe devi manaha tatha devi sukta japaschaiva yajno vahishu tarpanam. This is, I won't go to the details of different forms of worship. Sattvika puja, the most more exalted type of worship is mentioned here, where you offer simple things, you give more importance, you give more importance for reading the sacred hymns, sacred scriptures, meditating on the meaning of the sacred mantras. You chant the sacred names, you offer flowers, little, whatever is easily accessible or available, and you will be in a state of tremendous contentment. That is sattvika worship. Dadravanita rajasi balidanesha nivedehi samishastatha sura samamsa. So those who are practicing the rajasika worship may offer a lot of things because there is a lot of display. It's not that one is wrong or the other is right. What it means is these are three stages in our own evolution, in our own spiritual practice. So you find in those who have seen this puja worship pandals, may have seen a pot is displayed there. It's called Kalasha. So Ghata is called. Kalam sarira malinyam syati nasayati. So you find the water pot is kept there. It's called ghata, kalasha. And water is kept and flowers kept. So it is symbolic of purification of our mind, of all impurities. So many of these rituals emerged gradually. And we have to remember, there were 10 different types of Vedic documents, which are not Vedic, actually Smriti documents, like rules and regulations giving on different forms of rituals. They were all present in different parts of India. So there were slight differences with regard to the concept of the divine archetype. But then the fundamental principle is the same. Every image, every ritual is a way to transcend ritualism. You worship, you do puja, to reach a point where you go beyond the need to do worship. So this can be easily demonstrated from the life of Sri Ramakrishna. Now Sri Ramakrishna, when he came to the temple, Vivekananda's guru, at the beginning he was reluctant to take up this puja. Then he took up this responsibility of puja, and then he did with great sanctity and sacredness, which is called saddha. And then he reached a point where he could not do physically, he could not bring himself to perform any of the rituals. Not that he did not want. He could not pluck flowers because he found the flower or the leaf, all this also correspond to the divine reality. There is nothing in this world which is different from the divine. So the divine spiritual reality was present everywhere. This is a state of intuitive wisdom, intuitive experience. It is not an idea. This is a state where he reached, where you don't reject puja, you go beyond the need to perform worship. That should be our goal. So every external practice is meant to take us beyond external practice. But for that, we have to practice, we have to do the external rituals with great sense of sanctity, identification. That's why if you go to primary school, you have to work very hard, then only you will be able to reach the college. You cannot just decide, well, I won't go to school tomorrow, I will go to university. You can't do that. So it is a state of our own spiritual evolution. That's the meaning of it. Now coming to Navaratri. You know, this Navaratri is the season. It's called Navara. Means, literally it means 9 days. It's a festival which is meant to give a new and special kind of knowledge. That is, Vijnanam, by 9 nights of spiritual practice. In the early days, as I mentioned, the ancient Vedic sacrifices were held mostly during the spring season, Vasande Yajeda. The old Vedic rituals, yajnas, yagas, which may have existed before the emergence of these temples and pujas and worship, they used to have Vedic rituals, which were mostly conducted during the spring season. It's called Vasande Jeda. This is a statement in the Smriti literature. But later on, when this puja became popular, it came to be performed during the autumnal season. So there is a Sanskrit root called Nav, which means to praise, or nu. It originally comes from nu, the dhadu or root, Sanskrit root nu. The word nava. Nava means nayan. Nava means also eternal, always new, which is eternal. So that particular word comes from the Sanskrit root nu, which literally means to praise, to extol. So navam means navanam puranam. 9 days of praising the divine matter with Sraddha and Bhakti, with the great devotion, we practice this ritual. This is the symbolic significance of this Navaratri. Now, it also to be kept in mind that this particular celebration falls on Ashwa Yuj Masa, the particular month where the full moon is in Ashwa Yuja Nakshatra, and it is called Kanya Rasi, particular state, particular condition of the constellation stars. And it is suggestive of the mind being employed in the control of the senses. When our senses do not control the mind, but mind is able to control the senses, and mind is able to direct the senses into higher spiritual channels, So that is the significance of this particular astrological position. And this Navaratri also means nights of praise. So it means a time, Navaratri Vrata. When you practice this celebration for 9 days, stage by stage, you reach a point of the highest spiritual evolution. The beginning in most of the temples where the puja is not done very elaborate, it's called Saptami. Saptami means seventh. So Saptami, Ashtami, Navami and Dashami. These are the 4 days on which puja is worshipped. So there are people who practice this puja on Saptami day because they give more importance to the particular auspicious day, the Moola Nakshatra, this Ashwadhik Masa that you already mentioned here. And the next day is Ashtami. So Ashtami, the word itself is very significant. It comes from the root Asnu Vyapto. Therefore, it is suggestive of the omnipresence of Devi. Ashtami, very often, many of these rituals have some connection with the Sanskrit root of the word, and the Sanskrit root itself is self-explanatory, which reveals the significance of the worship done on the particular day. So, for example, Ashtami. Ashtami is the second of the most important day after Saptami. So that Ashtami itself comes from the Sanskrit root Asnu, which means omnipresent, where the Divine Mother is present everywhere. Somebody is called Durga Ashtami. So Durga itself is a spiritual symbolism, which means Durga, who is the one who is attained, who is realized, this all-pervading divine reality in the form of the cosmic feminine spiritual energy is realized, is understood to be a reality through austerities and practices. That's the meaning of Durga. So that puja is performed on Ashtami day. So Pura Ashtamyam Bhadragali Daksha Yajna Vinashini Pradurbhuda Mahaghora Yogini Kodibhissaha. So many of these mantras will tell you that on this particular day, the Divine Mother in ancient times was born to bless humanity. Now the mythological, what you call the Puranic, the mythological, the story background of the whole ritual is found in the Markandeya Purana, where there is a small section called Durga Saptashati. Saptashati means 700 Sanskrit verses, which extol, which deal with the manifestation of the cosmic spiritual energy as the Divine Mother for the preservation of dharma, truth, and also for the destruction of adharma, which actually is a threat to human civilization. So the whole event is depicted in the story symbolically in the form of a dialogue which involves, of course, there is a story background which right now I don't have time to go through. The text is called Durga Saptashadi. It's called Chandi is another name. When you refer to the text indicating the number of verses, it's called Durga Saptashati, 700 verses dealing with the emergence or manifestation of the divine energy as the divine mother. So there the whole story is depicted how the divine energy manifests, descended on this earth to bless humanity and to take us beyond the realm of worldly bondages. On the one hand, to bless us with whatever we need, and on the other hand, to take us beyond any kind of needs. So you find some ancient sages worship mother for spiritual upliftment, and they got it. Some others worship mother because there was a king who lost his kingdom and he was driven away from his own kingdom. So he worshipped the divine mother, and by mother's grace he got back his kingdom. So whatever you pray for, when you pray to God as a divine mother, you not only get the highest spiritual enlightenment, you also get what you need to make your life happy and pleasant in this world. So these two aspects you find only in this tradition of worshipping God as the mother, divine mother aspect of it. The next day, which is Navami. So Navu also comes from the root Nu, which again Navanam Puranam. There you praise, you worship mother for the highest spiritual upliftment and also for purification of our senses and mind. The last one is Dashami. It's called Vijaya Dashami. In some places called Dasha, you know, Dasara, Dashahara. It becomes in corrupted form. In the regional language, it becomes Dasara. So Dashami also comes from the root Dasha Deepto, the day of enlightenment or realization of God. So on Ashtami, one should see God in everything. On Navami, well, she should be served. Dashami should be realized in Samadhi. So something very interesting. Dashami is the day, the last of these Vijaya Dashami, you know, the last of this day, this worship, where you realize this omnipresent divine energy as a reality in your own life. That's why on this Vijaya Dashami, it's called Vijaya Dashami, people start their education. In some traditions in India, you find they initiate the Vedic education on this particular day, where the mother is worshipped as the divine mother who teaches us the secular knowledge. That's why very often the ritual involves ritualistic study of the alphabet. So small little children, long before they have embarked on their educational career, when they are very small, maybe third year or fourth year, maybe even younger, 2 years and 3 years, they are taught this alphabet. It is not the beginning of Vedic education. Is this the formal initiation into the world of knowledge? And that knowledge should not only take us to economic prosperity, secular prosperity, but also should take us to a state of spiritual wisdom, spiritual intuition, where we go beyond economic, secular comforts and prosperity. So that's why Dashami may also mean Dashascha Saumascha, representing Ishvara, because Dasha itself means realization, spiritual realization. Now, there are certain rituals involved in this puja. I shall conclude very soon, within maybe 10-15 minutes. There are certain very important rituals which are involved in this year. As I mentioned earlier, every kind of image worship or ritualistic worship is meant to take us beyond that particular state where we have to worship a visible external image. There are certain very strong, powerful statements in ancient scriptures which actually condemn those who consider image worship as the end of their spiritual evolution. Now remember, when we go beyond the need to image worship, it doesn't mean that we reject image worship, not at all. All the greatest spiritual teachers of India who talked about transcending image worship continued worshipping God. It's because in images. So there is an interesting story mentioned here. You can find such stories in the life of Sri Ramakrishna, Shankaracharya and others. But something that happened not long back in the beginning of 20th century. There was a great sage in Sringeri, one of the monasteries founded by Adi Shankaracharya. So he was supposed to be a man of realization, who realized the Advaitic, the impersonal, the attributeless, the transcendental reality, the presence of divine everywhere. And one professor whose acquaintance with Advaita was only through books, he went to see him. He was also a professor of Advaita, went to see this great Swami in Sringeri. And when he went there, the Swami was performing puja. There is a temple, Chandramaulishwara Puja. And the professor was disappointed. It was a professor from India. He thought the Swami has realized Advaita. That means now he won't go to temple or anywhere. You have to remember, Sri Ramakrishna, who had reached the Advaita Samadhi, Advaitic experience, used to ask, and he asked his own disciple, Vivekananda, to go and pray to Mother. You have to remember that. Sri Ramakrishna always told him, you pray to Mother, pray to Divine Mother. Now, when this professor went to this Sringeri, Mother Swami was performing with, you know, the rituals, the conch, flowers, all that. He was terribly disappointed. I expected to see an Advaitin who sits maybe in a study room reading books. But here is Swami with all this, the gowns of a worshipper, is performing puja. He was terribly disappointed. Then after the ritual was over, this professor asked the Swami, Swami, why are you doing all this? You have realized Brahman everywhere. Then what should I do? So what will you do? Suppose you are a great scientist. You are a Nobel Prize winning scientist, let us say. Will you stop reading books on physics? You don't stop reading books on physics. That's what you have been doing for ages. If you have got a Nobel Prize in computer technology, which I am not, and then after getting Nobel Prize in computer science, will you stop reading using computers? You won't do that. You may be a Nobel Prize winning writer. Will you stop using the alphabet which you studied in the kindergarten? The same alphabet you use to write a thesis, to write a Nobel Prize winning classic. So, then what should I do? What else should I do? The professor may have understood, we do not know. Anyway, that's where the story goes. So, all these statements do not mean that a highest Advaitin who has got beyond image worship will stop worshipping. He will continue. Only the point is, he must have gone beyond that. He won't tell you that image worship is the beginning and the end of religion. He won't say. So there are certain statements. Shivam atmani pasyanti pratimasu na yoginaha. Atmastam yena pasyanti tirtham margandi te shivam. The devotees who see God everywhere may not need to go in search of pilgrim centers. So those who can see God everywhere may not consider pilgrimages as essential. Just as a professor may not feel that what he studied in the kindergarten 50 years back is so very essential right now, but he will not reject it. That's why those devotees who are highly evolved, who see God in their own heart and not just in idol saloon, well, they won't require pilgrimages. So you find such statements. Dhyana yeknya parastasmat devan pashanam runmayan atyantam pratibadyanti shivam yadhatme devanath. When you realize this identity with the absolute reality within your own heart, then you do not give up rituals voluntarily, but you do not think, you will not think the ritualistic worship is the end of your spiritual journey. So there are many such statements which I'm not going to details. Now we'll come to some very important subjects in the ritualistic puja itself. So you find that all rituals begin with a statement. It's called sankalpa. It means statement means, I'm doing this puja, I'm doing this ritual for this purpose. That particular ritual is called sankalpa, which is done in a very ritualistic manner. So this sankalpa has two parts. One is the negative. It involves a prayer to Divine Mother to save us from all negative samskaras, all negativity, all, technically it's called sins, that's not a correct translation, from all obstacles, etc. So that is one prayer. That is, sarva papa prayaschittartham means, we may have wrongly performed or done something which is undesirable, so it will bear its consequences. So please save me from the negative consequences of some wrong deed that we may have performed inadvertently. So it's called sarva papa prayaschittartham. The second one is positive, paramatma preetyartham, which means eventually to realize the truth, the divinity of Atman everywhere. So on the one hand, so that's what we do when we begin the worship. It's called sankalpa. On the one hand, we pray to for blessing so that we will be able to continue and conclude this ritual without any obstacles. And also is a prayer to save us from the negative consequences of some negative actions we may have performed in our life. The second part of the prayer is positive. This ritual should take us to the highest spiritual enlightenment. So there are various stages in the ritual itself. So they may be broadly divided into two groups. One is preliminary and other one is essential. The early or preliminary part of the ritual contains Achamana, Manasa Puja, Prana Pradishtha, Pranayama, Bhudapasarpana, Asana Puja, etc. So Achamana, you can find people, the worshipper taking water in hands. You know, water is the essence of purification. So when you utter certain mantras, the water gets the potency to purify our mind. That's something very interesting, you know. You can find this happening. If we go to India, you can find this happening in maybe, I think in one church in Spain, perhaps there is a church where water is coming in a cathedral which is considered to be sacred. Now, if we go to India, you find people taking bath in the Ganga. Now, water in the Ganga is not the purest, most hygienic water in the world right now. Certainly not. Everyone knows that. But if you take a bath in the Ganga, thinking that this bath will help you to be mentally and spiritually pure, it give you purity, purification, then it may not do any harm to you. On the other hand, if you take bath in that river, this is the most polluted river even by Indian standards, and then take a bath, maybe you may catch typhoid or maybe some kind of illness. So you find strong faith has something to do at the physical level. So when a worshipper is called Achamana, takes a few drops of water and chants a mantra, which I'm not going to repeat right now, it's not proper, then that water is supposed to acquire a special potency to purify your mind Not the body. When the mind is purified, body also gets purified. In fact, that's the meaning of many of the rituals that did exist during the medieval times among the Dominican and Franciscan friars in medieval Europe. So this is one part of the ritual. The other part is called upacharas, means certain ritualistic practices which are more subtle. Avahana, asana, padhya, gargya, achamaniya, snana, vastra, yajna, pavida, the gandha, pushpa, diva, dhuba, all you can find all this. You find the worshipper offers to the deity this water, flower, incense, light, conch bell, and water for water, taking for drinking by the time of doing puja, naivedya, which means food offering and things like that. So one may ask the question, what does God need all this? You don't find God eating food or anything. If God ever starts eating food, we will stop offering food in temples or any places. We don't do that. The point is, when we do that with a sense of sanctity and sacredness, we are benefited. All these rituals are meant for our good. It is not in any way going to benefit God. And in Hindu tradition, Vedantic tradition, God is not very particular that you should respect Him. Absolutely. No condition. Absolutely. You can be neutral. But if you perform certain things for your own spiritual benefit, you reach there. That's all. So, this is very important. In Hindu Vedantic tradition, no God ever insists on your giving Him food or drinks, water, drink, or flower, or conch bell, or light, or incense, nothing. When we do this, we are actually being benefited. So you can think of this. You offer all these things when an honorable guest comes to you, visits your home. So as I mentioned, many of the rituals, the idea is the all-pervading divine reality is conceived to be an honorable God, honorable guest coming to your home, and you chant this mantra, which literally translates, please come here, be seated on this chair, and please accept our offerings, accept our prayers, and then with certain mantras, with a great sense of sanctity, you perform all this. It does something to our mind. That's very important. When we chant these mantras, accompanied by rituals, it does, and it should benefit our mind. Our mind begins to evolve. It takes on a journey. It begins to attach a spiritual sanctity and sacredness to the life, to the whole phenomenon of life as a whole. Such a person's his behavior, the words he speaks, the way he looks at the world will be different. So, external rituals do change our mind, our actions, our attitudes, our lifestyle. It should change. That's why every worshipper should slowly imbibe the qualities, the spiritual aspects of his idea of God. That's a very interesting aspect in this. Now, there are some other very interesting subjects which I want to discuss elaborately. You may have heard of this, you know, this. After puja, we keep a plate of sweets outside. It's called prasad lunch, that's what we call. You can find in our printed program. You don't say lunch in Vivekananda Hall. Prasad lunch. Why this prasad lunch? You can say lunch, prasad luncheon. And this prasad is something very, very important to do. So, now, the point is, whatever we offer, whatever is offered, things may be called as spiritualized or sanctified. And then it becomes prasad. So many of the ancient scriptures make it clear that the naivedyam that is offered to the deity should be distributed among those who are present and also among others also. More or less, it may have some similarities with the rituals taking place in Catholic churches and cathedrals. So, there are some statements here. One ancient mythological book, Brahma Purana, says, Vipravyaschatta desham brahmane yat nivedidam vaishnavam satadebhyascha basma ngaisischa bhaswaram sauram. So, it means, whatever you offer in temples, whatever temples, should be offered to those who look upon this ritual as something sacred and who believe in the sanctity and sacredness of that particular deity whom we worship. Because that's why Novayunja Nivetitam. So that's why this prasad of God should be given to all devotees, because it contains in it a spiritual element, not just food, but it becomes more potent spiritually by being offered to the deity. So it all depends upon our faith. When we believe in the sanctity of the rituals and also the deity whom we worship, and then we take something that we strongly believe was put in front of the deity, that will have a sense of sanctity and sacredness. And then there are many, many interesting, you know, namaskara. So there are certain other elements involved. For example, this conch. So conch symbol is a symbol of vital energy. We are offering vital energy. And food is a symbol of body. And water is a symbol of sense of sanctity and purification. Flower is a symbol of devotion. And light is a symbol of knowledge. And bell is a symbol of sound. It is also the symbol of the anahata dhuni, the transcendental sound dimension of the absolute reality. Now the point is, among the various articles required for puja, water represents sraddha. And namaskara, so you find namaskara. Namaskara means humility. Humility here, when you use the word namaste or namaskara, you're actually recognizing the spiritual divine spark present in the other person. You are not showing any reverence or respect to the particular person at the physical level. You are recognizing the presence of the divine reality present in the person to whom you say the word namaste. So like that, so for you, an ascertainment of truth constitutes asanam. So you offer asana to the deity. All these form part of the rituals. As I mentioned, when the honored guest is coming to your home, you place him, you request to be seated somewhere. So you offer him a seat. So you offer him flower as an act of devotion. And you offer him conch bell, as a, you know, it corresponds to the transcendental sound dimension of the absolute reality. And then you offer him padyam. Argyam is consist of free mind, and a gantha, that is, you're offering him this incense. And then this is called pradakshina. So pradakshina, people, you can find people going around circumambulation of the temples. So you are focusing your mind on the divine reality which is present everywhere. So when you are strongly convinced that the divine reality is present in the temple, when you go around, you are actually becoming one with the transcendental dimension of it. That's called pradakshina. And finally, when you, at the last part of the ritual, either in Durga Puja, elsewhere, you discard the image with a lot of prayers, with a lot of requests to come back again next autumn season. So, Uttame Shikhare Devi, you find the Gayatri mantra also in the evening Gayatri. In the morning you invoke Gayatri as the divine goddess corresponds to the refined wisdom. And evening you request mother to go back to her own celestial abode to come back next day morning when you continue your Gayatri Vasana. Like that, at the end of these rituals, you utter certain mantras and you pray to the Divine Mother to bless all, everyone, not only those who are present, but the whole creation. The mantras uttered during that occasion indicates that the worshipper is requesting the Divine Mother to bless the whole humanity, the whole creation. And then, with a request to come back again next year when we conduct this puja again. So you can find, on the one hand, it is very gross externally. You can see a visible form. You perform these visible rituals with visible things. But beyond all that and behind all that, there is this invisible, transcendental, impersonal dimension. That is why mother is requested to go back to her divine abode to come back again. And then this image is discarded in the flowing water. Because it becomes part of the five elements. The images are made out of five elements. And then by the devotee, because of his devoted chanting, his concentration and meditation, that worshipper, the devotee is invoking the presence of the divine impersonal energy within that image. And after all these rituals, the image part, which is made of five elements, it goes back to five elements when it is discarded in the flowing water with a request to come back again next year. So more or less, this process applies to all forms of rituals in temple worship. But I don't have time to go elaborately into many of these aspects. So anyway, it was an attempt to give a brief overview of the whole symbolism of divine worship. Thank you. Namaskar. Om Shanti 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 Harihi Om Tat Sat Sri Ramakrishna Arpanamastu.